Good day, this is Mary with the Talking Information Centre. It is May 26th of 2026, and I'm reading Newsmax. First story is, amid truce and active peace talks, US attacks Iran missile sites. US forces attacked missile sites in southern Iran, and boats trying to lay mines on Monday, U.S. Central Command said, even as top Iranian negotiators arrived in Doha for talks to end the war. U.S. forces conducted self-defense strikes in southern Iran today to protect our troops from threats posed by Iranian forces, Tim Hawkins, a Central Command spokesman, said in a statement. It gave no details of the attacks and said only that the targets included missile launch sites and boats trying to emplace mines. The strikes threatened an already fragile ceasefire that began April 8th as the United States and Iran struggle to reach an accord to end the war that has rattled the global economy with a severe disruption of energy flows. Hopes for an accord in recent days were dealt another blow when Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to crush Iran-backed Hezbollah in Lebanon. Iran has demanded that any peace accord apply to fighting in Lebanon as well. Trump also said in a social media post he expected Iran to hand over its enriched uranium to the United States to be destroyed, or have it destroyed in Iran with an international witness. Enriched uranium, nuclear dust, will either be immediately turned over to the United States to be brought home and destroyed, or preferably in conjunction and coordination with the Islamic Republic of Iran, destroyed in place or at another acceptable location, with the Atomic Energy Commission, or its equivalent, being witness to the process and event, Trump wrote. It was not clear whether he meant this is part of an emerging accord with Iran. The Atomic Energy Commission that Trump cited was abolished in 1974, and its functions were divided between two successor bodies. Earlier Monday, Trump said it should be mandatory for Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Pakistan, Egypt, Turkey, Bahrain, and Jordan to sign up to the Abraham Accords, a set of agreements brokered in 2020 with nations historically hostile to Israel as part of a peace deal with Iran. Trump said he had spoken to the leaders of those countries Saturday about efforts to end the war with Iran. Bahrain and the UAE have already signed the accords, along with Morocco and Sudan. U.S. and Iranian forces have observed a ceasefire since April 8th, while diplomats push for a negotiated settlement. Although Iran has maintained controls on Gulf shipping through the Strait of Hormuz, and the U.S. Navy has sought to blockade Iran's ports. While the Abraham Accords were welcomed by some, they remain deeply unpopular in many parts of the Middle East, in part because they failed to address the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Gulf heavyweights like Saudi Arabia and Qatar have said they will never normalize ties with Israel unless an independent Palestinian state is created. One critic of the administration's Iran strategies, Anna Jacobs of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, said Trump's latest demand added to the disaster that has been the war on all fronts for Gulf nations. The national security of the Gulf States has been threatened more than ever before because of President Trump's reckless decisions, and he expects Arab states to thank him and to normalize relations with Israel, which they will not do at the stage, she said. These expectations and assumptions from this U.S. administration shows how little they understand the Middle East. Trump demands came after Secretary of State Marco Rubio suggested a deal could be reached within the day, causing world oil prices to tumble based on renewed optimism about an agreement. We thought we might have some news last night, maybe today, Rubio told reporters during a visit to New Delhi, referring to hopes for a deal. But Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson, Ismail Barkhi, poured cold water on hopes for a final settlement. It is correct to say that we had reached a conclusion on a large portion of issues under discussion, he told a weekly news briefing. But to say that this means the signing of an agreement is imminent, no one can make such a claim. Meanwhile, some critics and media outlets have cautioned against Trump ceding leverage to Iran in the drive for a peace deal. For his part, Trump has continued to insist that any agreement will be tightly aligned with U.S. demands and will only move forward if it meets firm American conditions, even as officials acknowledge the framework remains under active negotiation. At the same time, Trump has increasingly lashed out at critics of the talks. He said they are attacking an agreement that has not yet been finalized and therefore do not understand its actual terms. On another front of the war, Netanyahu said Monday that he had ordered the military to intensify its offensive in Lebanon in an effort to crush Hezbollah, accusing the group of targeting Israeli forces with drone attacks. I have ordered an even greater acceleration of our operations, Netanyahu said in a video statement posted on his Telegram channel. The Israeli leader said Sunday that he and Trump had agreed that any final agreement with Iran must eliminate the nuclear threat entirely before peace was reached. Iranian officials have stressed that despite the long-standing U.S. demand for an end to uranium enrichment, the Islamic Republic has not agreed to halt enrichment activities. Also for Newsmax, Iran seeks release of $24 billion in potential agreement with the U.S. Around $24 billion of Iranian funds frozen overseas must be released under a memorandum of understanding being negotiated with the United States, a source close to Tehran's negotiation team said, according to a report by Iran's Tasnim news agency on Tuesday. The agency said Iran's top negotiator, Mohammad Bakhtiyar, had traveled to Qatar to reach agreement on a mechanism to implement this demand. Also from Newsmax, amid truce and active peace talks, U.S. attacks Iran missile sites. U.S. forces attacked missile sites in southern Iran and boats trying to lay mines on Monday, U.S. Central Command said, even as top Iranian negotiators arrived in Doha for talks to end the war. U.S. forces conducted self-defense strikes in southern Iran today to protect our troops from threats posed by Iranian forces, Tim Hawkins, a Central Command spokesman, said in a statement. It gave no details of the attacks and said only that the targets included missile launch sites and boats trying to emplace mines. The strikes threatened an already fragile ceasefire that began April 8th as the United States and Iran struggle to reach an accord to end the war that has rattled the global economy with a severe disruption of energy flows. Hopes for an accord in recent days were dealt another blow when Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to crush Iranian-backed Hezbollah in Lebanon. Iran has demanded that any peace accord applying to the fighting in Lebanon as well. Trump also said in a social media post he expected Iran to hand over its enriched uranium to the United States to be destroyed or have it destroyed in Iran with an international witness. And also from Newsmax, a Rubio aide gets top White House security job. A longtime aide to Secretary of State Marco Rubio has been promoted to assist to the President and Deputy National Security Advisor. Mike Needham, a former Rubio Senate Chief of Staff and longtime conservative policy operative, is moving into the influential White House National Security post as the Trump administration confronts growing challenges involving China, Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela, Axios reported Tuesday. Needham replaces Robert Gabarl, a close ally of the White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, is one of the administration's most important foreign policy jobs. Axios reported that Needham is well-liked throughout the administration and maintains strong ties with Vice President J.D. Vance's team. Rubio praised the promotion, saying Needham has played a key role in helping implement President Donald Trump's America First foreign policy agenda. Mike has been a key player in delivering President Trump's overwhelming foreign policy successes, Rubio said in a statement cited by Axios. In his new role as Deputy National Security Advisor, Mike will continue to implement the President's America First agenda and build upon the historic record of the Trump National Security Council. Needham has been part of Rubio's inner circle since 2018, when he left Heritage Action to become Rubio's Senate Chief of Staff. He later followed Rubio into the Trump administration and served as counselor at the State Department. Dan Holler, another longtime Rubio ally with ties to Heritage Action, is expected to succeed Needham in the counselor role. The promotion also further elevates Rubio's influence inside the Trump administration at a time when the Secretary of State is increasingly viewed as a central figure in Republican foreign policy circles. Recent reporting by the Dispatch described Rubio as one of the GOP's most influential voices on foreign affairs and economic nationalism, noting his close working relationship with Vance and the growing influence of the populist-oriented conservative thinkers surrounding both men. Needham himself has long been associated with that movement. In 2023, he left Rubio's Senate office to launch America 2100, a conservative policy group focused on promoting economic nationalism and confronting China's global rise, according to Florida Politics. Rubio at the time praised Needham's work, advancing policies aimed at reinvigorating American industry, community, and patriotism. Rubio at the time praised Needham's work, advancing policies aimed at reinvigorating American industry, community, and patriotism. The Dispatch also recently reported that Needham played a founding role at American Compass, the influential think tank helping shape the GOP's post-Reagan populist policy direction embraced by both Rubio and Vance. Also from Newsmax, the General Accounting Office. U.S. overpaid welfare and Medicare by $186 billion. Federal agencies sent out roughly $186 billion in improper payments during fiscal year 2025, according to a recent Government Accountability Office analysis that found Medicare, Medicaid, and welfare-related programs accounted for much of the total. That figure marked a $24 billion increase from the prior year, the New York Post reported. The GAO said that 15 federal agencies reported improper payments across 64 programs, with about 82% tied to overpayments. Medicare accounted for the largest share at $57 billion in improper payments. Medicare followed at Medicaid followed at $37 billion, while the earned income tax credit accounted for $21 billion in payments to ineligible recipients. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, commonly known as food stamps, recorded roughly $10 billion in improper payments. The Shuttered Venue Operators Grant Program, created during the COVID-19 pandemic to support live entertainment venues, museums, and theaters, also recorded about $10 billion in excess payments. The remaining programs combined accounted for another $51 billion in improper payments. The General Accounting Office said improper payments have remained a long-standing issue across the federal government, estimating agencies have issued roughly $3 trillion in improper payments since 2003. The watchdog agency also said the actual figure could be higher because some programs considered vulnerable to improper payments were not included in the latest estimate. The report comes as a federal forward task led by Vice President J.D. Vance pushes states to strengthen oversight of federal aid programs or risk losing funding. Kristen Kosislek, Managing Director of GAO's Financial Management and Insurance Team, told the Washington Times that the largest increase in improper payments occurred during the COVID-19 pandemic between 2020 and 2023, when emergency programs expanded rapidly. The GAO said it has repeatedly urged Congress and federal agencies to improve oversight and accountability measures designed to reduce improper payments and fraud risks across federal programs. And President Trump pays tribute at the tomb of the unknown soldier. President Donald Trump paid tribute to America's fallen heroes Monday during a solemn Memorial Day ceremony at the Arlington National Cemetery. He placed a wreath at the tomb of the unknown soldier and honored the men and women who gave their lives defending the nation. Joined by Vice President J.D. Vance and War Secretary Pete Hegseth, Trump participated in the traditional wreath-laying ceremony at the cemetery overlooking Washington, D.C., pausing in silence before the marble tomb that has stood as a symbol of sacrifice for more than a century. A military bugler played taps as members of the armed forces stood at attention and a crowd of veterans, Gold Star families, and supporters looked on. Earlier Monday, Trump marked Memorial Day with a message praising U.S. service members and celebrating what he called a new era of American strength. He also took aim at political opponents, extending Memorial Day wishes even to the radical left Democrats, while arguing the country is making a comeback under his leadership. Arlington National Cemetery remains one of the nation's most sacred military sites, serving as the final resting place for more than 400,000 service members, veterans, and their families. The Tomb of the Unknown Soldier honors unidentified American troops killed in war and has been guarded continuously since 1937. And Speaker Johnson to Newsmax, the GOP will keep and grow House majority. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican Louisiana, told Newsmax's Todd Starnes that he is confident Republicans will defy historical trends and gain seats in this fall's midterm elections, arguing the GOP's focus on affordability and economic issues will resonate with voters. I'm absolutely convinced of it, Johnson told Starnes on Monday in an interview that will air Tuesday on Starnes' radio program, The Todd Starnes Show. Johnson acknowledged that the party controlling the White House traditionally struggles in midterm elections, noting that it's only twice in the last 90 years that a sitting president has picked up seats for his party in that first two-year cycle. But we are the group that defies conventional wisdom and makes history every day, and we're going to do it again, he said. Republicans hold a slim House majority after retaining control in 2024. When President Trump won re-election and Republicans swept the swing states, Johnson said several factors give Republicans an advantage heading into November, including candidate recruitment, fundraising, and Trump's continued campaigning. We've got better candidates than the Democrats do, Johnson said. We have a fundraising advantage for the first time in over a decade, and we have a great political environment, he said. He also credited Trump for keeping attention on the stakes of the election. We have a president who's out running like he's on the ballot, doing rallies and events and making sure people understand the necessity of the midterms, Johnson said. Johnson argued Democrats are increasingly dominant by their far left wing, which he said is alienating voters. The Democrats are in total disarray, he said. They're on the verge of an open civil war in their party. Johnson also warned about the rise of what I call many Mamdanis, referring to what he described as actual Marxists running for office on the Democratic side, such as New York Mayor Zohran Mamdani. Johnson said Republicans must remain focused on economic concerns facing Americans, particularly rising living costs. Every election really is at a certain extent about kitchen table issues, he said. The cost of living is a big issue, Johnson said, adding that affordability has become the buzzword right now that Democrats are using, but argued Republicans have focused on the issue longer through tax and spending policies. Our legislation, our marquee achievement of this Congress so far, the big, beautiful bill, the Working Families Tax Cut, and all the legislation that has preceded that and followed it has been geared toward making government smaller, more efficient, more effective, and putting more money in the pockets of hard-working Americans, he said. Johnson pointed to high fuel costs tied to tensions involving Iran and the Straits of Hormuz as a major factor driving up prices. Grocery prices are elevated a little bit because when gas prices are high, it takes more money to transport those goods to your local marketplace, he said. So it's all tied in together. And the DNC pulls the Memorial Day post after rebuke from party combat veterans. A Memorial Day social media post from the Democratic National Committee, which called to remember the 13 soldiers killed in the US-Iran military conflict and blamed President Donald Trump for their deaths, was pulled down after two lawmakers from their own party, both combat veterans, said the graphic politicized their deaths. It's incredibly distasteful to use our heroic dead for a political attack on Memorial Day, said Senator Tammy Duckworth, Democrat, Illinois, on X while sharing a link to the post. I'm a Democrat, and I condemn this post by the DNC. DNC's graphic included photographs of the killed military personnel and said that today we honor the American heroes who made the ultimate sacrifice in Trump's war with Iran. Duckworth, a Black Hawk helicopter pilot during the Iraq War, was shot down in 2004 by Iraqi insurgents, suffering wounds that resulted in the loss of both of her legs and an injury to her right arm. She served in the army from 1992 to 2014, including being in the Army Reserve from 1992 to 1996, before transferring to the Army National Guard in 1996. Representative Jason Crow, Democrat, Colorado, also served as an Army Ranger, including 3 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, also posted on X to criticize the "If we want the morale high ground, we have to be better." Crow said, "I fought for our country and served with those who made the ultimate sacrifice. It's wrong to politicize this day. I won't hesitate to call out my own team when we fall short." The DNC post went live at about 11 a.m. Friday, with Duckworth speaking out against it at about 6:25 p.m., and Crow's post following shortly thereafter at 6:38 p.m. The DNC deleted its graphic at some point after the lawmakers' posts. Meanwhile, earlier on Memorial Day, Crow and Duckworth posted social media messages recognizing the sacrifices of fallen soldiers in our nation's history. "On this Memorial Day, we remember all those who made the ultimate sacrifice for our country," Crow said in his video, which was recorded near the Korean War Memorial in Washington, D.C. Duckworth, meanwhile, said in her post that, "On Memorial Day, we remember our fallen heroes who answered the call, not for themselves, but for democracy. In their names, it's on each of us to live our lives in a way that honors their sacrifice." And also from Newsmax, futures gain as AI optimism outweighs Mideast risks. The U.S. stock index futures, rose to record highs Tuesday, catching up after a public holiday, and optimism as AI-related stocks offset some concerns over Middle East peace talks following recent U.S. strikes on Iran. Iran's Tasnim news agency reported that Tehran is seeking the release of $24 billion of Iranian funds frozen overseas in the deal that's being negotiated with the U.S. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said on Tuesday the deal could take a few days, while President Donald Trump said in a Truth Social post on Monday that talks with Iran were going nicely. Investors still appear willing to buy dips on the assumption that the conflict ultimately de-escalates, said Daniela Hawthorne, senior market analyst at Capital.com. Brent crude oil rose as much as 2%, and global stocks wavered as uncertainty lingered over whether a deal would be reached to open up shipping flows through the Straits of Hormuz. The semiconductor stocks, which have surged on AI-driven demand, led gains in pre-market trading. Marvel Technology rose 5.4%. Micron climbed 6.3%, while Intel and Qualcomm added 2.9% and 3% respectively. U.S. stock futures were sharply higher early Tuesday as investors looked ahead to another busy day of economic data and corporate earnings. As of 8:15 Eastern Time, S&P 500 futures climbed 50.25 points, or 0.67%, to 7,541.25. Dow Jones Industrial Average futures gained 276 points, or 0.54%, to 50,938. NASDAQ futures led the advance, rising 320.25 points or 108% to 29,879. The broad-based rally in futures signaled stronger sentiment on Wall Street following renewed optimism around technology and artificial intelligence stocks. Wall Street has been trading at record highs, with upbeat earnings and confidence in AI trade driving equities higher, despite the ongoing conflict with Iran. The blue-chip Dow became the last index to hit a record high on Friday, its first since the Iran war began, while the S&P 500 posted its best winning streak since December of 2023. With the earnings season nearly over, first quarter earnings growth is expected to be 29% year-on-year compared with the 16.1% estimated a month ago, according to LSEG data from Friday. Kevin Warsh was sworn in as chair of the Federal Reserve on Friday. His appointment comes amid growing concerns about inflation, driven by higher oil prices, which have added to expectations of tighter global monetary policy. Markets currently expect the Fed to keep rates on hold for the rest of the year, with a 25 BPS rate hike seen in December. U.S. consumer confidence data for May is expected later in the day, with higher gasoline prices due to the Middle East conflict expected to weigh on consumer sentiment. Among early movers, Joy jumped 12% after the Chinese social live streaming platform posted first quarter revenue above the expectations. Pony AI shares climbed 11.1% after the company said it plans to expand its robo-taxi fleet. And also from Newsmax, Machado is running for Venezuelan president. Nobel Peace Prize winner Maria Corina Machado, leader of Venezuela's opposition movement, said she plans to return from exile and enter Venezuela's next presidential race before the end of the year. Machado has remained in exile since December, when she emerged after 11 months in hiding in Venezuela and went to Norway to receive her Nobel Peace Prize. I will be a candidate, but there may be others, of course, she said, while visiting with the Venezuelan diaspora on Saturday in Panama, according to La Prensa, a Spanish-language outlet in Panama City. Also attending the meeting were the politicians from the Unitary Platform, the main political alliance of Venezuela's opposition parties. I would love to compete with everyone, with anyone who wants to be a candidate, she said. Machado said the opposition maintains a single goal, which is to rescue Venezuela and bring back millions of citizens who emigrated. We have a mandate, we have a path, we have a strategy, and today we have not only strong political leadership, but also a cohesive, determined, and organized society like no other, she said. After the U.S. captured Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro and returned him to New York to face federal drug trafficking charges, according to the Trump administration, President Donald Trump chose to work with Maduro's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, rather than back Venezuela's opposition movement. Although Machado celebrated Maduro's removal as an historic victory, she has had to navigate a delicate diplomatic balance regarding the U.S. tragedy that followed. She continues to reject the legitimacy of the current arrangement, saying a true democratic transition has not yet been achieved. She also continues to push for free, fair, and internationally monitored elections in Venezuela. Machado has focused her public messaging on portraying the U.S. as a fundamental ally. She has framed the U.S. intervention as a necessary first step toward restoring freedom while avoiding statements that could alienate Trump. Still, it is unclear when Venezuela will hold a presidential election. Trump and senior administration officials have praised Rodriguez, who has opened Venezuela's oil industry to U.S. investment amid surging oil prices tied to the war in Iran. Machado on Saturday spoke about unity among opposition parties and said that despite political and ideological differences, they would work with a single purpose, the freedom of Venezuela. She also said Venezuela's political process is entering a definitive stage and that the opposition seeks to dismantle an entire criminal structure through a transition that would restore democratic institutions. Machado rose to become Maduro's strongest opponent in recent years, but his government barred her from running in 2024 presidential election, leading her to choose Armando González Urrutia, a retired ambassador, to represent her on the ballot. Officials loyal to the ruling party declared Maduro the winner mere hours after polls closed, but Machado's campaign collected evidence showing González defeated Maduro by more than a 2-to-1 margin. Also from Newsmax, Representative Massey says more Epstein names coming and teases a 2028 comeback. Representative Thomas Massey, Republican Kentucky, is not retreating from public life after losing the Republican primary for Kentucky's 4th Congressional District to a candidate backed by President Donald Trump. Massey, a libertarian-leaning conservative who often clashed with House Republican leaders and Trump, has threatened to expose more high-profile people named in documents related to Jeffrey Epstein. He's also accused Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche of withholding key evidence connected to Epstein's sex trafficking operation and concealing the scale of the network. In February, Massey took to the House floor to criticize the Department of Justice for failing to aggressively prosecute wealthy individuals implicated in the files. He publicly named three prominent figures who he argued DOJ should thoroughly investigate: Liz Wexner, Leon Black, and Jess Staley. Yes, Massey told NBC Meet the Press on Sunday when asked whether he will reveal more names in the coming weeks. Massey was a driving force behind passage of the Epstein Files Transparency Act, which requires the DOJ to release unclassified records and investigate materials related to Epstein, who died in federal custody while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges. His death was ruled a suicide. Todd Blanche is violating the law, Massey said. There are still millions of files that haven't been released. We know from talking to the victims' lawyers that their own FBI interview summaries, known as 302 forms, haven't been released. We know that files have been over-redacted. I have released at least three names of billionaires who are implicated in this. Massey's, whose bid for an eighth term ended in a loss to retired Navy SEAL officer Ed Gelron in the May 19th Republican primary, vowed to continue pushing for disclosures under the Epstein Files Transparency Act, regardless of whether he remains in Congress. So, if we can't get this Attorney General and this FBI Director to do the right thing, the next one who takes those seats are obligated by law to release the files that these individuals are not releasing now, he said. DOJ said January 30th that it publicized more than 3 million additional pages, along with 2,000 videos and 180,000 images, bringing the total number of released pages to nearly 3.5 million. But Massey has asserted that internal data suggests the full scope of documents exceeds 6 million pages. Meanwhile, Massey on Monday said he filed paperwork with the Federal Election Commission for the 2028 election. I filed with the FEC for the 2028 House race, he wrote on X. This allows me to raise funds to continue my political operations, supporting my position as a current office holder and as a potential candidate for federal office. I haven't made a final decision about which office to seek if I run. In his concession speech, Massey's supporters urged him to run for president in 2028. He told the Meet the Press, who wouldn't rule out anything regarding his political future. Look, I've spent the last 5 days on my farm with my grandkids and my cattle and my peach trees. And it's a pretty nice life, he said. I don't know if I want to screw that up again. I've been in Congress 14 years fighting. Every hour that passes, I get decompressed a little bit more. It's like coming up from the bottom of the ocean, and I'll take some time and decide what's next. But I think I will stay engaged in some way or shape. Maybe it's from the outside. I've been exposing what's going on in Washington, D.C. for years, and I'll keep doing it. And also from Newsmax, California chemical tank explosion risk eliminated. A crack has relieved some pressure in a damaged chemical tank, and the temperature of the highly flammable gas inside it is continuing to fall, leading authorities to say Monday they believe the risk of a catastrophic explosion has been eliminated. Nevertheless, an evacuation order remains in place for some 50,000 residents of nearby Garden Grove, just south of Los Angeles. An overnight evacuation of the tank containing 6,000 to 7,000 gallons of methacrylate produced incredibly positive news, Orange County Fire Authority Division Chief Craig Covey said, although the risk to public safety is ongoing. The crack in the tank at the GKN Aerospace Transparency Systems plant was discovered Sunday. Authorities have detected no hazardous chemical levels as of Monday. Officials said they need to cool the tank to prevent a toxic leak or explosion. The tank's interior has cooled to 93 degrees Fahrenheit, Covey said Monday, down from 100 degrees a day earlier. The tank might eventually cool enough for crews to safely stabilize and drain the remaining material without triggering a spark or ignition, said Andrew Wheatland, Purdue University engineering professor who has studied environmental contamination. Welton cautioned that there is still some risk of an explosion while the chemical inside the tank remains hot and reactive. He said temperatures need to fall closer to the ambient levels, roughly 60 degrees to 70 degrees, before conditions are considered significantly safer. After the tank overheated on Thursday and pressure built, officials said it began releasing vapors. As the interior temperature rises, methyl methacrylate, which is used to make plastics, converts from liquid to gas, increasing the pressure and risk of explosion, Welton said. Some of the methyl methacrylate may already have hardened into stable plastic similar to plexiglass, reducing the risk inside the tank, he said. The release of pressure likely released at some chemical, at least some chemical, into the atmosphere. And what responders are able to detect depends partly on the type and placement of monitoring equipment. If the device isn't right next to the tank, then it's not necessarily surprising that they're not detecting high magnitudes of chemicals, Welton said. Exposure to methyl methacrylate can cause serious respiratory problems, neurological problems, and irritation to the skin, eyes, and throat, according to the Environmental Protection Agency fact sheet. Orange County health officials said the chemical is easy to smell, and people may notice it over a large area without being harmed. Authorities have not defined what a catastrophic explosion might mean, but said Monday the worst-case scenario is off the table. Kim Yan, a retiree who was forced to evacuate her Garden Grove home, said she had been closely following the news and was relieved to learn that the worst had passed. I'm happy, and many of us are happy, but we are still on our evacuation, she said. Yan, who lives two blocks from the plant, said she had already returned home but first wants to be sure it's safe. And she said she's been worried about the emergency crews. They are really our heroes, Yan said. The parking lot was full Monday at a large park in Fountain Valley, just southwest of Garden Grove, as people sought refuge in an ad hoc shelter there or pitched tents outside. Other people gathered in the park to enjoy Memorial Day. GKN Aerospace Technology Transparency Systems, who owns the plant, is a British company that makes cockpit windows, canopies, and windshields for military and commercial aircraft. GKN Aerospace Technical Specialists and the Orange County Fire Authority removed external insulation material from the tank to help cool its contents, according to GKN Aerospace statement released Monday. We apologize for ongoing disruption and this incident is causing, and our priority remains its safe resolution so that residents can return to their homes as quickly as possible, the statement said. GKN Aerospace says on its website that it employs about 16,000 people across 32 manufacturing sites in 12 countries, and supplies technologies and components used by major commercial and military aircraft manufacturers worldwide. It remained unknown when the operation would reopen. Air and Space agreed in 2025 to pay state regulators more than $900,000 to settle violations involving record-keeping, permitting issues, and nitrogen oxide emissions, according to a report on the South Coast Air Quality Management District website. Disruptions at facilities produced specialized aircraft components can be difficult for the global aerospace industry to absorb because supply chains are highly concentrated and already strained, said Richard Abulafia, managing director of the aerospace consulting firm Aerodynamic Advisory. Abulafia said aerospace manufacturing differs from many other industries because aircraft production rates are relatively low, leaving only a small number of suppliers for many specialized parts and systems. There's just not a lot of margin in the system, he said. And Dr. Birx to Newsmax. Americans not at risk from latest Ebola outbreak. Former White House COVID-19 response coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx told Newsmax on Friday that Americans are not at risk from the Ebola outbreak spreading in Congo and Uganda. She also said on American Agenda that the United States is far better prepared than in past outbreaks to contain and treat any potential cases. What happened was, because there was such a delay in reporting, all of these cases occurred 2, 3, 4 weeks ago, and they're just getting counted now. So it looks like the epidemic is skyrocketing, but it's really condensing 4 or 5 weeks of infections into 1 week of reporting, Burke said. For everyday Americans, they should have a great Memorial Day and a great Memorial Day weekend. They are not at risk. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a health advisory on Tuesday regarding the outbreak caused by Bundibugyo strain of Ebola virus. The CDC said that the risk of spread to the United States is considered low at this time. The World Health Organization has declared the outbreak a public health emergency of international concern after hundreds of suspected cases and dozens of deaths were reported in Congo and neighboring Uganda. Burks noted Ebola spreads through contact with bodily fluids, not through the air like COVID-19. These people are very ill. They're vomiting. They have diarrhea, she said. You heard how much they bleed, and so there can be a lot of fluid. Burks said the virus can survive on contaminated surfaces for days, making protective equipment critical for healthcare workers treating infected patients. That is why it's so important that they're adequately protected, she said, noting workers are thoroughly decontaminated after treating patients. Burks also praised U.S. containment procedures developed after previous Ebola scares. What everybody in America should be reassured by is, after the last time we had Ebola in the United States, the federal government really set up containment facilities. These biocontainment facilities in several hospitals around the United States. So, we actually do have the facilities to treat people who potentially get infected. The CDC advisory said no suspected probable or confirmed Ebola cases tied to the outbreak have been reported in the U.S. as of Monday. Burks also highlighted promising experimental treatments under development, including pan-Ebola monoclonal antibodies designed to work against multiple Ebola strains. It's really important that we're not always working with the last epidemic, but we're getting prepared for the next one, she said. And also from Newsmax, Indiana, 283 undocumented truck drivers stopped in inspections. Nearly 300 undocumented migrants carrying commercial driver's licenses issued by states, including New York and California, have been stopped and prosecuted in Indiana over the past 3 months, the New York Post reported Saturday, citing comments from an aide to Republican Governor Mike Braun. Tony Ferrero, a Braun aide and member of the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission, said during a recent meeting that authorities identified 283 undocumented truck drivers during inspections at the Indiana way stations, according to the Post and the Chicago Tribune, which first reported the remarks. That's over 3 a day that we pulled out of trucks, Ferrero said, according to the Post. Ferrero said many of the drivers carried commercial driver's licenses, or CDLs, issued by states, including New York and California, that permit non-citizens to obtain licenses under certain circumstances, the Post reported. Indiana officials did not specify what criminal charges were filed against the drivers, or whether the licenses themselves were deemed invalid, according to the report. Federal rules generally require CDL holders to be legally authorized to work in the United States, though the Post noted that some immigration and licensing rules vary by state and may depend on when credentials are issued. Indiana does not issue driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants. And Braun's administration has stepped up highway inspections and immigration-related enforcement efforts since taking office earlier this year, the Post reported. Republican Attorney General Todd Rokita also backed tougher immigration enforcement policies, including expanded cooperation between local law enforcement and federal immigration authorities. And Congress moves to limit investor home buys. Congress is moving toward restricting large institutional investors from buying single-family homes as lawmakers from both parties respond to voter frustration over rising housing costs. Bipartisan majorities in the House and Senate, according to Politico, have backed legislation that would block large investors from purchasing more single-family houses. Housing analysts say the measure may have only a limited effect on affordability nationwide. "We want homes for people, not for corporations," President Donald Trump said in his State of the Union address in February while endorsing the proposal. Large institutional investors own less than 1% of single-family houses and about 2% of single-family rental properties nationally, according to figures cited in the debate. Tobias Peter, co-director of the American Enterprise Institute's Housing Center, said limiting investor purchases could free up some inventory for buyers, but might also reduce rental availability. "So it's probably a wash," Peter said.